You're tuned to New Sound Radio 92 FM on DAB, streaming live around the world, and I'm Pete Day. Well, the big football clubs, they've been playing, albeit to empty stadiums, for a few weeks now. And, well, if like me you're a West Ham supporter, you can maybe just about breathe a sigh of relief that relegation has been avoided. However, the smaller non-league clubs, they're yet to resume matches, and the decision was taken some months back to abandon what remained of the season. East London has always had, of course, a proud tradition of local amateur and semi-professional non-league clubs. Well, earlier on, I met up with Michael Foley in a, well, I don't know, a socially distanced telephone kind of way, that is. He's the president of Ilford Football Club. And I asked him, well, how exactly has lockdown and COVID-19 affected both him and his club?
Strangely, our attention was first drawn to the scale of the problem, I think, in our very last match, which was cancelled at very short notice because one of our opponents had gone down with the symptoms. And that was our first face-to-face confrontation with this thing, which everybody assumed was not going to be lasting for long. But as it emerged, of course, it has been a far more serious and traumatising thing for many people at different levels. For me personally and for members of our club, it's afforded the opportunity to get on with other things, catch up with admin, try and recruit the people who might wish to be sponsors for next season. In many respects, it's not been a bad time because as volunteers in local amateur sport, very often you are rushing from pillar to post during our playing season, not just on match days. So in a way, I feel quite chilled and a little bit guilty for it too.
Okay, yeah. The thing is, of course, the big clubs, you know, the league football, that's all gone back, hasn't it? When are you planning to go back? Have you heard the latest? You heard anything about that?
Suggestion for football clubs at our level is that it's going to be September. I think they've taken the safe option and shut everything down for now.
So, of course, you haven't got the resources in the way that league football has. I mean, they're testing all the time and they can sort of get doctors in and things like that. I mean, obviously, non-league football, you just can't do that, can you? You haven't really got the resources to do that.
Not in any sense. The game at our level is totally governed by money or absence of it. We tend to limp from one week to the next. It's a constant battle for survival, and it's down to the skills or resourcefulness of two or three people to keep the wheels going.
Now, of course, you're an historian. People talk about unprecedented times. Can you think of any other time going back through the history of Ilford Football Club or just football in general when anything like this has happened before?
Not at all. I think there were certain parallels in 1914, again in 1939, when the game was abandoned, but most people seemed to feel that it would be for a very limited time. Yeah, there was a sense of disbelief then, as there has been now in many quarters.
And also, of course, there was a massive flu outbreak at the end of the First World War as well. Did that disrupt football at all in Britain?
I've seen no evidence for that. Of course, in worldwide terms, it was catastrophic. But no, the professional and amateur games in and around London resumed in 1919. Interestingly, for Ilford, a number of players who went to war in 1914-15, served on the Western Front, did return and were still kicking a ball around into the mid-20s.
Okay, yeah.
Not all, one or two died, of course.
Of course, yes, that would have been a big issue. So, of course, you're involved in Ilford Football Club. I mean, how far does Ilford Football Club go back to?
We were founded in 1881 as a village side, which, of course, places like Ilford were at this stage. And I think the population around the turn of the century was just over 11,000. And as such, we played other fairly local village teams in and around London and into the Essex and Kent countryside. Our first trophy of any recognition was the Essex Senior Trophy, Essex Senior Cup in 1888-89. So that's within the first decade. We went on to win it on a further 12 occasions, and it became the major tournament for the county. So I think that the formation of the Southern League in 1894, which we joined, was quite pivotal because it was formed to rival the Northern-dominated Football League, which clearly by then was all professional, and indeed most of the Southern League clubs joined that bandwagon. Ilford refused to and promptly dropped out after two seasons along with one or two others. And that kind of defined our progress or lack of it up until the formation of a league, the Isthmian League, in 1904. Interestingly, when we pulled out of the Southern League, we were replaced by a pretty much unknown side called Tottenham Hotspur. And then we're very much geared to be on the professional bandwagon.
And why did Ilford not really want to, like you call it a professional bandwagon, why didn't Ilford really want to join that and get involved in that?
That single question really forms the basis of the book I've recently had published on the history of the club. The people who actually owned the club or ruled it at this time, they tended to be property building people. They tended to have civic associations. They'd be councillors or aldermen. They'd be pretty prominent on the local council. And I've made the case that it was not within their interests to expose themselves to the scrutiny that comes along with shareholding and having to publish accounts and so forth. And they wanted to keep it largely parochial. They wanted to keep it a game whereby you played your local rivals and weren't travelling vast distances every other Saturday. In many respects, they did a good job. Certainly Ilford would have been a professional club, and who knows where that journey may have taken us if that course of action had been implemented.
Of course, you know, non-league football, there's a lot of people involved in it. I mean, how did you get involved in it? I mean, what drew you to it?
I used to attend football with my father as a young boy in the 60s and in the early 70s. We used to go to Upton Park. I used to go to the Valley. My father was an ardent Charlton Athletic fan. And if there were no professional sides at home, we'd go to Ilford. And I was always taken by the atmosphere at these non-league games and the fact that you could actually hear what players were saying and the referee was saying to them and so forth. It appealed to me. It's like watching a film at the cinema, but being part of it yourself, feeling like you're close to the centre of the action. That was very appealing to me as a child, and not only knowing the players' names, but even getting to know one or two of them and being a part of it.
Of course, professional football, league football, has become very much a corporate affair, loads and loads of money in it as well. Do you see that as a problem?
The problem for people who work in amateur football, or even in the semi-professional game, is that vast millions generated by the Premier League and do not filter down to clubs at our level. This is a massive problem because more and more clubs are starting to feel the squeeze, and one or two already have disappeared. There is a disillusionment with the corporate side. I think there is an opportunity there for well-run amateur clubs like mine and to attract those who are disillusioned or those who can't afford a family season ticket anymore, and there are many of them. We live in hope that we might be on the verge of turning some kind of corner. But I do stress that we play in front of very low crowds. You know, if we have 50 to 100 people at a home game now, it means we can pay the referee and the officials and we don't have to worry for another 7 days. And these are the fine margins that exist where I operate and where so many of my colleagues are in clubs at a similar level. I don't feel we're getting the support that's required from the footballing authorities, and that's not particularly controversial. I think virtually everybody would share that same view.
And of course, you know, yeah, for famous clubs as well, like you say, clubs which go back right the way through to, you know, 1881. That's an amazing thing. And of course, you mentioned your book. Could you just tell us something about your book? I understand it's called Resurgam, yeah? God, can you tell us why you called it that?
That's become our modern day cry of defiance, if you like. It means I am revived or I am resurrected in the Latin. The club, which went out of existence in the late 70s, following the loss of its ground and a couple of hastily arranged mergers, was revived. And I'm proud to say that I was a part of that in 1987 with my father and with one or two other supporters. And we fought a very long and arduous campaign with Redbridge Council for recognition initially, for use of a ground with the potential to have the infrastructure in place. And it took 7 years before we were fully restored to our place as a senior club. The book, I suppose, came about, my father passed away 10 years ago now, in recognition of the fact that time is passing on. Many people who remember the old club, the club from the mid-70s and the decades before, many people are not around or they've moved away. Those who do have memories, without putting too fine a point, may not be around in 50 and 20 years' time. I then became associated with wonderful person in Gerard Green, who's the manager of the Redbridge Museum and Heritage Centre, who encouraged me to write the history of the club, bringing it up to the present. we were successful in achieving the award from the Heritage Lottery Fund. The book is one strand of that funding, and there's a lot of educational aspect to it as well, going into schools, holding heritage sessions for local people. But the next major part is going to be an exhibition of the club's history, and it's linked also to a social history of the town itself, which the club has always been so proud to represent. And we are putting together the final pieces of that jigsaw in terms of the archives we're going to need to use. It should be due for launch sometime in early 2021.
And finally, what's the one thing, the one thing that makes Ilford Football Club such a special place? What's the one thing that makes it really special?
I think it is the history of the club, which is so remarkable in many ways, and the challenge to make known as much of our history as we can. How many people, if you're an Ilfordian past or present, how many people actually know that we've had full internationals, that we've played at Wembley in national cup finals, that we've played FC Barcelona on their own ground on four occasions? How many people know these things? And wonderful to see eyes light up when this realisation is brought home.
Michael Foley, historian and president of Ilford Football Club, thanks for joining us here on New Sound Radio 92 FM.
Thank you, Pete.
And if you want to get yourself a copy of Michael's book, Resurgam, it's about the history of the club, or if you want to just maybe know more about Ilford Football Club generally, the place to look is on their website. It's a bit of a long web address, though, so probably your best bet is to just Google Ilford Football Club. I mean, or use another search engine, and you should find it okay. And since recording that interview, the Football Association have said that grassroots non-league games can start from September the 1st, with guidelines stating that clubs can begin competitive training with overall group sizes limited to just 30 people, with pre-season friendlies and small-sided competitions allowed from the beginning of August. Now, lots of guidelines and restrictions, though. Frequent hand sanitising and goal celebrations there to be avoided. Whilst players and officials should arrive early, kitted up already, already changed and ready for the match. Yeah, and showers, they have to do that at home after the match, not in changing rooms. They're not going to be used. Clubs should also keep records as well of who attended the matches and training sessions. That's for the track and trace purposes, obviously.